So, I guess it's time to start. Welcome to this very first lecture of summer 2015. My name is Helmut Seidel. The lecture is about virtual machines, which is a lecture belonging to the broader area of programming languages and compilers. So it is dedicated, or it is meant to be attended by students on the bachelor level from the Wahlbereich, or I think there are computer scientists who might be interested in that. Who is computer scientist bachelor? So there are a few. Then there is the possibility that you might attend because you have selected that and you are studying TUM BWL. Is there somebody from that? And you can also attend it on the master's level if you are specializing in this area. Is there somebody studying something completely different? Some gaming person? No gamer. What did I want to say? So as you see, this lecture is recorded, and we will provide the recordings online. I also will upload the slides, and there's a book covering most of the topics discussed here. So there's a sufficient wealth of material. There also will be a tutorium and homework related to this lecture, given by Stefan Schulze Frielinghaus. He's attending a conference today and during the whole week. So therefore, exercises will start next week. And that's perhaps decent, because before that we have not so much to exercise on. And the other thing is, together with this exercises comes an implementation of the virtual machines discussed in this lecture, so that you can not only program these virtual machines, but you can also let them run and get a visual feedback what's going on in your program. So that might be helpful. But what else? So when you do, now you may wonder, is it important? Is it useful to deal with these exercise sheets? And the answer is yes, for two reasons. One reason is, if you have done these things, then you are well prepared for the final written exam, and you will pass with a great mark, which means it's a low mark. But it also provides, so in order to give you extra reason to deal with these homeworks, there's also, if you acquire 50% of the points, you get a bonus. So this is, you can upgrade your mark, your final of the written exam by 1, which means by 1.3 or so. So that if you have 1.3, then you get a 1. But as usual with these upgrades by means of bonus, be aware. So you first have to pass the exam, the final exam, and then you get the bonus. But as I said, if you did the homework, then you are well prepared, and so you definitely will pass the exam. So is there some more organizational questions, perhaps? So that we will discuss next week. So I don't know that when Stefan has reserved a room. How many people will be interested in attending the exercise? Just to get who's not willing to attend it? So everybody. So this means, so then we can just look at what we see in TUM Online, how many people will attend, and then perhaps we do two groups, if one, I guess, would be too many for one group. There's one more thing. We have reserved two-hour slots for the lecture, but the lecture is only 3 hours a week. So this gives us freedom in some weeks to lecture two sessions, and in some weeks to lecture one session. So this week we start with one session, so tomorrow there's no lecture, because I will also go to the conference where these others are, and will stay there for the rest of the week. So therefore, tomorrow is no lecture, and next week we then proceed again with two lectures. There's one more thing. So if you are interested in programming languages and compilers beyond this lecture, you might also consider attending this companion lecture by Michael Petter on compilers, which is a 2 hours lecture. Okay. So that is these things. I hope I did not forget anything very important. But if you have no further questions, then we might start diving into the subject. Virtual machines and for compiling. So what does it mean? So therefore, let me briefly try to recall the principles of compiling and the role, and then to explain the role of virtual machines within this process. So you all use compilers, I guess. At least whenever you do programming, you have to use a compiler. And compiling is then, so what is the problem? So the problem is you write a program not in the language understood by computers, but you write programs in a programming language. And somehow you must kind of, you somehow therefore have the problem to bring your program to the computer. And in the middle, there is the compiler. So in principle, it need not always be a compiler. So there is, you could kind of, instead of compiling your program before you run it, you could also use an interpreter. So what is an interpreter? An interpreter takes the program together with the input. So there's no pre-processing, just the program and the input. So everything what you need to get your task done is fed into the interpreter, and then the interpreter takes the program and interprets on the fly, if you like, the structure of your program and executes it as soon as it sees it and produces the output. So that is the advantage of this mode of processing is that the interpretation may start immediately. So otherwise, a compiler may work, if you use a compiler for a comparison, this would work on the program for quite a while, and that means the startup time is very, could be quite high. Now here, if you have an interpreter, ideally the startup time is zero. You immediately can start running, and and so if the so that might be a big advantage. On the other hand, if you use this principle of interpretation, the interpreter does not see the future of the program, but only the current construct in the program, and therefore cannot make use of the potential for optimizing the execution. Because typically what you write down is not offers a lot of possibilities for improvement, and might be rather inefficient because the programming language typically does not match precisely the capabilities of the executing processor. So therefore, there could be certain redundancies and whatnot in the program, which cannot be identified by the interpreter, and therefore the program will be slow. But if you use your program only once, and you take the combined time of getting your program executed, and the combined time consists of the startup time plus the execution time, then still this might be much slower, much faster than when you spend ages for getting the highly optimized program out of highly optimized code out of your program, which then runs only once. So then opposed to the interpreter, there's this principle of the principle approach of using a compiler. So when you want to get your task done by means of compilation, then you divide the whole process into a two-stage thing. In the first stage, you have no input, you only have the program. And then you do a pre-computation on the program alone. And the pre-computation is as follows. So you generate from your high-level programming language program a low-level programming language program. In most cases, a low-level program which directly can run on the machine. And then, in the next stage, you take this residual program, if you like, which can now directly run on the hardware. And this one communicates with the user to take the input and produce the output. Okay, and now this pre-processing stage has one disadvantage. It does not know the input. But it has the big advantage that it has a bird's eye view on the whole program. It can look at all parts of the program, see what is there, what is going on to with the data, can choose suitably efficient data structures which are well suited for the whole program behavior. And it can find out certain redundancies, remove them, replace one algorithm by another algorithm, ideally, and by that may increase significantly the execution speed. But this admirable process of improving the code requires time. So therefore, typically, compilation takes some time, depending on the optimization level which you choose. So if the optimization level is very low, then compilation might be fast, but the code might not, but the resulting code quality may be so la-la. So, but if you really try to squeeze out the least, the maximal amount of efficiency out of the generated code, then this might take some time. But afterwards, so what you invest here, you might gain later when the program is executed. But as I told you, you always have to consider the sum of all execution times which you intend to have, together with the startup time of pre-computation. And so if your program is shipped to a customer who will run it arbitrarily often, it is worthwhile doing a decent compilation beforehand. So if you use your code several times, it might be worthwhile doing a compilation. Also, if you run your program only once, but the program runs very long, for a very long time, then it still may be worthwhile to use a compilation, because if it gains you a factor of 2 and you run for a year, then you will see it makes a difference between 150 days and a full year. Yeah, so in that sense, a compilation is then the method of choice. So these were two ideal these design choices. Clearly, there are things in between. So think of the Java compiler. So the Java compiler first is so computes some kind of intermediate code by a minimal amount of preprocessing, which is very little, and then starts interpreting this intermediate code. And then only when the program runs very long, it starts to optimize the intermediate code. So by that, it tries to reduce it, the startup time, and kind of get the best of both worlds. So these kind of things are possible. So in that sense, these two ideal design choices, either interpretation or compilation, it's not like 0-1, so, but there are choices in between. Okay. So now, thinking of a compiler. Now, a compiler takes the program alone and tries to produce takes the program in a high-level language and tries to produce code in a low-level language, ideally in the machine language of the processor, of the target machine. So this is a complicated task, and so if it's complicated, you should apply techniques from software engineering to get the work done in a decent way. And compilers are structured typically in different modules, you might say, or components. So the first component typically is what one would call the front end. So this is a purely syntactical beast. It takes, because your program is written in a programming language, and the language has a syntax. And as you all know, if you violate with the rules of the syntax, mess up with the rules of the syntax, your compilation will not work, will fail. And so you have to obey these rules. And this is on the negative side. You have to obey the rules. But on the positive side, this allows the compiler to find out what you mean. To find out what the program is. And it also might find out certain trivial programming bugs. So that is the task of the front end. So it takes the source program and then produces tries to understand the syntactical structure of your program and produces an internal representation of the code. Typically, this internal representation is kind of a tree. So, because programs, as you all know, are in some sense they are structured, meaning that there are brackets, opening and closing brackets, and there are may nest programming constructs. And so, this nesting of programming constructs is represented internally by trees, by a decomposition tree of your program. And okay, so now you have a representation of your program on which the compiler may operate. And so there, then the compiler does all kinds of computation, typically optimizations, and they kind of always take an intermediate representation and return another intermediate representation, which might be the same or might be different. So there are some compilers use only a single internal representation, which is good for everything. Others kind of have different representations in different phases. And so then now at some point the compiler decides, okay, now I eventually have to generate code. And this is the final phase. and then in the end you get your target machine code. So even that might not be just one, even this component might not be just so straightforward. Often there is still another optimization phase which now operates on this target machine code, doing things like register allocation and things like that, instruction scheduling, instruction selection, and so on. So there's a lot of work there, and this area down here, I would say, is currently the most active area of research and development in compilers. And the reason is that the target machines are very diverse, and getting diverse even every day, if you like. And the reason is that the limits of sequential computation efficiency has kind of more or less reached, and more efficiency can only be gained by introducing more and more concurrency into the architecture, and there are multiple ways of doing so. So you could have pipelining, you could have multi-threading, you could have multi-cores, and so on. And so this makes the architecture very very diverse. It's kind of it's no longer such a classical thing as we might have learned during our introductory courses. And so there are a lot of challenges for the compiler and clearly also for the programmer, as you might know. Okay, so that's the structure of the compiler. Now, where's the virtual machine? So, So somehow I kind of mentioned these three types of tasks of cogeneration. Now, what about but since the real machines are so diverse, cogeneration typically, or sometimes, or since a while, since a while, is in many compilers no longer is no longer going directly to the real code, but has some intermediate abstract machine code in between. And so this means cogeneration goes in two stages. So starting from the intermediate representation, one would provide first this abstract machine code. Abstract machine code means code for a machine which is a little bit idealized. So it's not like the real machine code, but it's a kind of it's kind of conceived by the designer of the compiler, consisting of useful instructions and useful data structures, but it is already quite low level. And so this kind of again, thinking of Java, this abstract machine code corresponds to the JVM code, to the contents of these class files produced by the Java compiler. And then in the next stage, you could do two things: either you take this virtual machine code or abstract machine code and interpret it together with the input to produce the output. This is kind of the one possibility. Or you use kind of a post-compiler to translate this abstract machine code into concrete machine code, which then runs on the machine. Now, why should one insert this intermediate code for a machine which is not real, but kind of only virtual. So what kind of reason could one have to do so? Have you any idea? Is it extra complication? Does it help?
Maybe the structure of the real machine changes very often, and then I don't have to the steps so often if I change some structure of my machine.
Yes. So it kind of decouples kind of the translation of the high-level programming constructs, of which there are many, from the task of generating code for the real machine. Because somehow you have the compilation process is kind of endangered, or the compiler is endangered by two things. One thing is the programming language, where people might add new and more and more sophisticated and stupid features, like, for example, lambdas in Java, or perhaps generics in Java. So you need a way how to deal with these, how to produce code for these. And this is one thing which is endangers the compiler. The other thing which endangers the compiler is that the target machine may be outdated very quickly. Every 2 years or so, you have a new processor, and then what should you throw away your all the investment you have put into the compiler. And so here in this case, if you have this intermediate level of abstract machine code, you can kind of either adapt the high the you have decoupled the translation of the high level programming concepts from the treatment of the sophisticated architectures. And so in that sense you can you have more possibilities for reuse of your parts of your compiler. Okay? And the other thing is, so that is one thing. That this makes the compiler easier to modify, and also it makes from a conceptual point of view, it makes the task of mapping high-level programming concepts to very low-level code is error-prone and complicated. And if you look at I don't know whether you had ever a close inspection of x86 instructions, or if you had ever a close a detailed view, for example, at the semantics of C++, then perhaps C++ inheritance, then you see that these are concepts which are quite far away. And so thinking of both together might be really hard work, and having this intermediate level simplifies the task considerably. So that makes the compiler easier and also easier to modify. And also, and that actually was the original reason for having virtual machines, makes the compiler more portable. Because you can, the first phase of compilation is always the same, and the only thing what you need is to have to provide a mapping from the virtual machine architecture to the real architecture, which might be not so difficult a task if the virtual machine is suitably designed. Okay, so now what is now, as I said, the virtual machine is conceived by the compiler designer for in view of a particular programming language. So therefore, you have all the design choices at your hand to design this architecture. And the question is, how should you do it? So clearly, you could make your virtual machine very close to the programming language. So then the first phase is very simple. Or you could make it very close to the real hardware. Then the second phase is very simple. So in this, so as you see, there are these two principal design choices. So therefore, or these, if you like, corner cases of a spectrum of possible design choices. So here is how to really design the architecture. Therefore, it's a matter of taste and of engineering, kind of to mediate between these between the extremes, so that both tasks are sufficiently simple, so that the first phase to translate the complex programming constructs is not too complicated, and also that the translation into real code also is easy. Yeah. So, but that also means when I kind of will explain to you certain virtual machines and their instruction sets, their data structures, and how to compile into these. There always will be different design choices, and we will discuss several of them. So, therefore, it is not so that everything here is kind of so that I preach like like rules of nature, which you have to learn by heart. But it is kind of I show you one decent choice as an example for how these design choices could look like. Okay. Now, what kind of these? Here I show you a list of virtual machines which have been provided for various kinds of programming languages. So, two of the earliest virtual machines were those provided for Pascal. And then for Smalltalk. And for Pascal, this virtual machine, this was the P machine, designed, I guess, by Nikolaus Wirth. And this P machine was responsible, or at least in my view, was responsible for this overwhelming success of Pascal in the early days, at least. Because of this P machine, Pascal was suddenly available on virtually every architecture and computer of its time. And since it was there, it was used. While other programming languages had much more difficulties to be available, and so people didn't use it. And Pascal was a nicely designed, not too stupidly designed language, and this P machine allowed it to port it to all kinds of architectures, so therefore people used it. And it, at least in universities, it was very popular. It was the kind of the first, I guess, for many years, the first language taught at universities. Okay, then also Smalltalk was based on a bytecode. So Smalltalk, who knows Smalltalk? Who has ever programmed in Smalltalk? So this was one of these very early object-oriented languages, very innovative in its time, and object-oriented and no untyped. So it was a very flexible language, and so people were very enthusiastic about it. They had its first graphical user interface, and so that was a big thing, and it the success was the flexibility, and everything could one way how to achieve it was by compiling it to bytecode. Then the next language in my list here is also a very old but still very interesting language, which is Prolog. Who has ever programmed in Prolog? Ah, so these are some more. What did you use it for? In the first course, so. Uh huh. Where was this? Of where?
Athens.
Interesting. So, Prolog. So it was conceived at least by a linguist together with a theorem prover, and so it made a proof principle, namely resolution, as the core machine, the core execution machine or execution principle of a programming language. It's a very interesting language, but when it was first conceived, at least the first Prolog systems were extremely slow. You could make only toy examples with it. It was actually not usable. I recall when I was a PhD student, we gave practical courses with Prolog, so just to playing around, and it was so everything was extremely small. You could do virtually nothing. It used tremendously much memory and very slow. And the breakthrough, how to it at least in some way was more or less became a usable programming language was by this Warren Abstract Machine, which is a virtual machine for designed for Prolog together with a compilation of Prolog into this virtual machine and a bunch of optimizations. And that made it a real, and then you could use it as a real language. So it's not so popular as you, but for certain tasks in artificial intelligence and perhaps also linguistics, still it may have its virtue. And then the next class of programming languages, which were kind of became practical by means of virtual machines, were these functional languages. So functional, the mother of all functional languages, which is Lisp somehow, and Lisp was kind of the competitor which outperformed somehow everything and in the functional world for many years, and had big systems and so environments and libraries and everything. So, but then and so these new languages, SML and then later Haskell, had where they kind of came from a different area. Who has ever programmed Haskell? Aha, so there are, and so in Tobias Nipko's course, or where did you learn Haskell? And SML? Also a few. So SML comes from the theorem prover corner of the world. the big advantage of these modern functional languages is their strong type system. They have very flexible and expressive type systems which allow to capture a lot of programming errors, which you would see in other languages. And so that if you once get a Haskell program or an SML program through the type checker, then you have a non-zero chance that it is already correct, more or less. Not always, clearly, but this captures a lot of programming errors, so that is on the good side, but also these systems were kind of suffered on that people for some time did not know how to compile them appropriately. And what made life hard was that you have these higher order functions and partially applied functions, and people did not know how to deal with that. And then came, this was in the 80s, so you see it is already, from your perspective, perhaps Stone Age, or perhaps, early Metal Age. So at that time, in the 80s, so there was kind of a lot of research in this area, and they came up with various forms of virtual machines and in some sense they captured the kind of the key principles how to implement these kind of functional objects. And so this STGM is the spineless tagless G machine. So G machine was kind of a machine for SML originally, I guess. And G stands for graph machine to deal with functional languages. So that was the machine for Haskell, which is also a lazy language. You have to implement this laziness. So that makes also life hard. And So, but nowadays, I guess the modern Haskell compiler does no lo- of maybe has the binder's tagless G machine in the back of the head or so, but kind of goes directly to C or directly to native code. So because these compilers now are quite mature, the languages are mature, and they go for speed now. And then clearly, as the one of the later examples, I should not make it black, so it's not so on the black side, Java or similar languages like C#, they kind of go to also to kind of intermediate code. I mentioned it already several times. For Java, it is this JVM. For C#, it is what? What is the...
CLI.
Yeah, this is this... Yeah. So they also have their bytecode, and they also can compile other languages to this bytecode, also to this JVM code. Nowadays, there are other languages compiling to that, like Scala, for example. And so because it's just a particular form of architecture, you could compile, and then you can benefit from all the machinery, like this hotspot compilation, to improve, to get a decent running time out of your program. Okay, so that is what goes on in the real world. Now, what goes on in this lecture? In the lecture, we also will discuss kind of a wealth of different virtual machines. And in some sense, the goal here is to cover all programming language paradigms, all major paradigms which are around. So we start with an imperative language. For that, we use C. And we provide a virtual machine for C. Now, in some sense, I like to say that this is a ridiculous enterprise. Why? Why is this particularly ridiculous? Well, C, in some sense, yeah? It's a low-level programming language, or at least the success of C is not that it was available at everywhere on all the computers due to a virtual machine, but it was available or is available due to, as it is the language of the operating systems in which they are kind of realized. So it is shipped together with the operating system to do all this low-level programming, and so to put a low-level machine, a virtual machine, between C and the real machine, in this sense, doesn't make so much sense. But we do it here just to see how the concepts of the language C would be implemented. So that is our goal, and then we can kind of pimp it up a little bit and put it to get a virtual machine for something with objects. This is C++. Why C++? So it's not full C++, because C++ is a monster. And so, we like monster, but perhaps here where we are kind of thinking about the principles, we do not want to go into too many ugly and ad hoc details, design decisions, and so we look at a simplified C++. And in between, before we go to the object-oriented world, we will also look at a functional language, which is close to my favorite functional language, which is OCaml. And so this is also, we will use OCaml syntax here, but look at the core, the functional part of it, and see how to compile it into this strange machine, Mama. And then we will have a simplified prolog, which we will also compile to a virtual machine, which is the Vim. And here, for this, and in the end, we will also, if we have time, and I guess we will also then again take up the core virtual machine for C and extend it with threads to get a to see how one would deal with multi-threading in a virtual machine. So this is the program, and now I still have not yet told you why we are here only looking at the compilation from the programming language into the virtual machine. So this has two. From a teaching point of view, this is virtual machines are nice as it allows me to explain to you how to compile high-level constructs without resorting to these ugly details of concrete architectures which may change overnight. If I show you how to compile, say, functional languages to x86 instructions, and then tomorrow this is dead, and you will have to provide a backend for an ARM processor or whatnot, then you have to do yourself to try to figure out what was the semantics of these stupid old instruction set, and how do I map it to this other instruction set. And so here we have a kind of a clear cut so that we can concentrate on the kind of the first on the problem, how to get high level programming constructs to low level code, and this is our virtual machine code. Yeah, and at the same time we learn how to design virtual machine instructions and virtual machine architectures, so that when you have the task to design your a compiler for your favorite domain specific language, you have a collection of recipes how to easily come up with a virtual machine first, and then quite easy to implement on the real machine. Okay, so this is for the program. Are there questions? Okay, so then we start with a translation of C. So C is on the one side and the C machine is on the other side, and we might now think, should this C machine look like? What is this virtual architecture, which should be kind of an abstraction of a real architecture, but much simpler, so that we kind of hide a lot of technical details. So now this abstracted architecture, what does it consist of? Well, it provides us as a real architecture with a set of instructions. So, given the set of instructions and their meaning, the task is to translate a program in C, into a sequence of such instructions. Now, in order to do so, we have to kind of fix not only what kind of instructions are around, but also what they mean. And in fact, these instructions operate on hardware. Now, here we have a virtual machine, so we have to provide a virtual hardware. Now, what is a virtual hardware? Now, a virtual hardware is nothing else but kind of a collection of data structures, simply data structures which these virtual machine instructions operate on. And we have to provide these data structures. And now if you want to interpret this sequence of virtual machine instructions, you have to do, in some sense, the same thing what a real hardware also has to do with its sequence of instructions. You need kind of a runtime system which takes one instruction after the other of the sequence and executes them on the hardware, which means on the data structures. Yeah. So we need a runtime system. Okay. So now let's see. So that is a kind of, abstract nonsense. Now let's see what for this our favorite programming language C, what do we need there? Okay, so once again, we could use anything and only it is more or less suitable for our task. So it should be not too close to the language, because then we gain nothing when we generate real code. But it should be kind of, it should kind of be an idealized, simplified hardware. So what would we provide for? Well, the minimal thing which we need kind of is a store. Okay? So, and the store is nothing but an array which is indexed. You can access the memory cells. So this is the data structure S. And this you also have in your real, you have your memory, you can address it. So here we use kind of a word addressing. So we kind of, if you address, you have an address 0, okay, then you have address 5, and that you get, then you get the content of the memory cell with this address. Now, in the real machines, you kind of can address every byte, and if you have, you can kind of address also, if you can access starting from a byte, a double byte or a 4-byte or 8-byte, depending on what kind of instructions you have. But here we make it and if you look at at virtual machine code, like for the for Java, they provide instructions for dealing with these different data types. So if you really go for a real programming language, you have to care for that. Here now comes that we have a lecture, and we try to be as simple as possible. We do not try to be as complicated as possible. We mentioned where you have to do add-ons, but here we try to be as simple as possible, and therefore we only have data values of one size, and that is so you have only word addressing. So therefore, if you increase by one, you get the next word and not the next byte. So that is kind of our convention. Okay, so that is so that means everything fits. Every basic data element fits into one storage cell, and okay, and then we have, besides this this data store S, we also have something, another thing, which is this stack pointer. And the stack pointer so when I say stack pointer, this indicates that this store is not just a store, but besides this addressing, direct addressing of each memory cell, you also have we kind of insist that the data elements are kind of packed on one side. Here we pack them starting from 0. I guess if the runtime stacks in real machines often grows in the opposite direction. So it starts from from the largest address and goes downward. But here, for simplicity, we just do it here in this way. And so, somehow, now if you pack your data on one side of your array, and you kind of, then you have the possibility of pushing more elements, and that is very easy by means of the stack pointer, because you increment the stack pointer, then you get the next free memory cell. And you can pop it, and then you kind of push a pop. You can decrement the stack pointer, and by that you can pop off the topmost element of your data structure, and that is an easy way of and a cheap way of memory management. And it will turn out to be a very useful form of memory management, which occurs at least twice for when compiling certain language features. Okay, so that is. This data store will be maintained like a stack by means of this stack pointer. Okay? Is there a question? And this, SP This is a point also which we have. This SP, you could call it, can consider it as some kind of extra variable holding an integer value inside the runtime system of our virtual machine. But if you think of a real hardware, then typically among the registers of your processor, you typically use also one dedicated register, which is called SP or something similar, and which is the stack pointer, because there also you maintain runtime stacks. Okay, so that is for data. Now a program also needs storage for the code itself, and we here assume that there is a separate a separate segment in memory which only contains code. And this is so here in the virtual machine we model it as an extra array, which is simply independent of the other array and is of a fixed size, and this contains the code, and we call it C. And now you also have to index this this array, and this is indexed by means of an integer valued variable of the runtime system, which we call PC, and this is program counter. And also every real hardware typically has some kind of register called PC, which is serving as a program counter. Okay. Now, clearly, if you want to start execution of your program, you somehow have to initialize the PC in such a way that it points to the first instruction of your program. And so here for simplicity, we assume that program execution always starts with the instruction at which comes first, and this sits in C at position 0, at address 0. Okay? So now we have two data structures, namely the array S and the array C, and two registers, namely stack pointer and PC. And now let me now come to the runtime system. So this means the runtime system should kind of take one instruction after the other and execute it. Now how is this done? So for that, this is done within this little while loop, and here you see what it does. It refers to one additional auxiliary variable. This is this instruction register IR. And now what is going on? So the first thing is you take the instruction pointed to by the program counter and load it into this instruction register. Oop, I wanted to have it in red. So this is going on here. Once you have done that, you increment the PC, and then after having incremented the PC, you execute the instruction which has been loaded into this register IR. Now you see the instruction which is loaded into IR is nothing else but in reality, like a sequence of bits or so. So therefore, this execute kind of has to interpret now this instruction and in order to run it. Yeah, this in the real machine you have a similar loop for execution loop. Only that it is more complicated because you additionally have kind of pipelines and whatnot, the kind of extra infrastructure, out of order execution and not. But in principle, you have a similar loop, and here you kind of this interpretation, this execution of the instruction is done by hardware. So there is a hardware thing which interprets the bits to find out what has to be done. Here I kind of made one extra assumption. I should have mentioned it on the slide before. Now here I simplify the world considerably by assuming that every instruction fits into one memory cell. So this is, I may assume for my virtual instructions, but we might wonder how close this is to the behavior of the real machine. And then the answer is, how close is this to the behavior of a real machine? Is it also there the case that all instructions have the same length? There are instruction sets where instructions are of different lengths. At some time, these RISC instruction sets were popular, where every instruction had the same length. But if you think of x86 instructions, they could vary in length. So therefore, this loading of an instruction is a more complicated process. You have to kind of start loading, then start interpreting, and see, this instruction requires further arguments, which then have to be also loaded and kind of glued together with the instruction. So, but here we simplify the world, so every virtual machine instruction has the same length, so that we can kind of load it directly and kind of interpret it. Okay, so then the next thing is, please note that we first increment the program counter and then execute the instruction. And the reason is this one, that there are instructions which themselves affect the program counter, namely jumps. Because a jump simply means you override the PC with another address where program executions should continue. In this way, you would implement a jump. Now, if you kind of first execute the instruction and then increment the PC, you would not jump to the place where you would like to continue, but you would jump to the one step before the place where you continue. This is kind of an awkward thing, and in order to kind of be more uniform and so that the jump really jumps to the location where execution should continue, we by default increment the PC, but this incrementing of the PC may be overwritten by the execution of the instruction. Okay? Now the other thing which you should notice here is that the loop is main execution loop is a while true loop. Yes? So you could do it. This is possible. But you have to take that into account, so that you kind of, if you say jump to A, then this A should be the label should be put one address before the place where you really want to continue. Yes. Yes. You could do it, but you have to jump then to another position, namely to this position one step before, so that you kind of, by that the increment would go to the right position. So it's only, you always can do it, but the question, so here is the design choice not to do it like that, in order that you really jump to the position where the execution continues, and that's it. It's a design choice, so it's not so... That the other thing could also be made possible. The next thing is that we have this we that that we have that this is a while true loop. That is, this execution will go on forever, which is good if your program is meant to go on forever, but not every program is meant to go on forever. Some should terminate. How can you terminate your program? And for that, we therefore provide one extra instruction, which is this one. This is the halt instruction. And the halt instruction, executing the halt instruction, kind of jumps out of the loop. It's kind of a break, and interpreted as a break, and jumps to the or a return statement, and jumps and gives control back to the operating system. Yeah. So now we have already one instruction. We have learned one instruction, namely the instruction halt, and so we can already write programs for our C machine, simply consisting of this instruction halt. Okay. Now, but that is not very interesting. So this kind of this minimal program is not so interesting. On the other hand, and we would like to have more. And to cover the rest of C, we need more instructions. But since it is a bit, so we try to kind of provide them on demand. So whenever we have a particular concept to realize, a particular construct in the language to realize, we will see whether our instructions set is already sufficient to deal with it. And if not, we will provide additional instructions. And sometimes we will also have to provide additional data structures to operate on. Okay? So that is kind of the way how we will go. So now, so therefore we will start at looking one first at simple and concepts of the language, and then at more advanced concepts, and try to think and how to realize them. So the first thing which we want to do is to deal with expressions, arithmetic expressions. So this actually is something which is provided by virtually every programming language, and in particular for imperative programming languages. And now, here is such an expression. It's a very simple expression, as you see, because it does not contain program variables. So in that sense, in some sense, this is again a little bit a ridiculous exercise. Why? Why is it ridiculous to design a sequence of instructions to realize the evaluation of such an expression?
Well, the compiler will pre-compute and will just put the solution for this expression.
Yeah, so any decent compiler would do constant propagation, would find out, oh, there is a sub-expression which whose value I can determine at compile time. And then the compiler would evaluate this expression at compile time and would replace it with the result. Yeah? So this is one typical form of optimization which virtually every compiler does. But if one has this, if you run the compiler without optimization, then it would not do it. It would kind of translate this into a sequence of instructions. And here we start with it. Clearly, we do it in this way because variables require extra thinking, and we start with a minimal amount of thinking. We concentrate on the structure of this type of expressions. Namely, we have how do we translate constants? How do we translate application of arithmetic operators? And how we deal with this nesting? Yeah. So these are the problems which we have to cope with. And so the goal when to translate such an expression is to produce an instruction sequence which is equivalent, which means when when executing the instruction sequence, the result should be the same as the semantics of the language expects from this expression. Yeah? So we will not, the goal is not to to produce 24, but a sequence of instructions which, when executed, will result in 24. Okay? And now this instruction, this sequence of instructions, which is meant to evaluate to 24, somehow must return this value somewhere. Yeah, because an expression should return a value. Now, where can our virtual machine return a value? Now, this should be a dedicated place in our virtual machine. It's a kind of convention. We could provide an accumulator thing, which is an extra register, which holds the result of an arithmetic operation. We could provide also several of these accumulators, and in fact, real machines do this, things like that. Some do this like that. But here we are perhaps a little bit more, a little bit reluctant with introducing new registers. We kind of return it on the top of the stack. So this is our convention. Yeah, this is also a special place in our data structures, which by convention our translation schemes adhere to this convention, we can rely on it so that we know whenever a sequence of instructions has been executed, this SP register points to the result of the expression. Yeah? So this is our convention which we introduce. So the result should be on top of the stack. Now, and the other thing is what we also want to have. So now there are some data in the stack. And when we evaluate the expression, we do not want to destroy the values which we might have accumulated already inside our stack. So therefore, the new value which is returned for the expression should be pushed on top of the stack. So the stack pointer should be incremented and then the value should be stored. So this is also important. Yeah? Because otherwise we have no guarantee that the rest of the stack will be the same. Yeah? So these are two conventions, and these two conventions help us to design, to generate the code. Okay? Now, that is this thing. Now let us see. Now look, how would we go for the how would we deal with this composite expression? So we see on the top level, the operator is a multiplication, and this multiplication is applied to two sub expressions. Now, what we would kind of the kind of idea which at least I suggest is that we use a recursive form of evaluating expressions. This means before we evaluate the multiplication expression, we first evaluate the first argument of the multiplication, then we evaluate the second argument. These are two sub-expressions. By our convention, these two values will then sit on top of the stack, and then we will execute the multiplication. Now we think a little bit. Okay, so these intermediate results are no longer necessary after the multiplication. So the multiplication may throw away these two arguments, kind of consume the two arguments, and push the new result on top of the stack. By eating up the arguments and pushing the result, kind of we remove the garbage which we produce. So in that sense, there's no trace after evaluation of the expression. We leave no trace of all the intermediate results we have produced. So in this sense, we have a perfect garbage collection and a clean stack. Yeah. So this is our idea. So in order to realize this idea, this gives us this aha. I said the multiplication must eat up its arguments and return the result. So this gives us the idea how we realize the multiplication instruction. So we need a multiplication instruction because with halt, with the instruction halt, we will not be able to do multiplication. So we need a new instruction. And the semantics of this, and it should operate on the stack in this way, as it takes the two topmost elements on the stack, it multiplies them, eats them up, and replaces them by the result. Yeah? Okay. So that is, and in some sense this seems to us plausible, that instructions, all instructions, which we will design, will be in a similar way, will behave in a similar way. They expect their arguments on top of the stack. They consume their operands. They may return results. They may have also side effects. But if they return results, they do it on top of the stack. Okay? So this is, again, kind of a, we could have done it in a different way, but this is our design choice, which seems plausible to us in order to deal easily with this, with evaluation of expressions. Okay. So now we have an idea how instructions should behave, and now we can look at the ingredients, what kind of instructions we need for implementing these expressions. So the simplest expression is a constant. For example, the constant I should 5. And now the instruction 5. I write again 5. So for that, we provide an individual instruction, load constant 5. So this, because this 5 is a compile time value, because it's part of the program, and therefore we can write this 5 directly into the code. Therefore, load constant 5 is one instruction. So, speaking aside, this is a kind of a problem. Why? Because if you have, for example, a 64-bit architecture, and then you have 64-bit constants, and so all 64 bits are covered by the constant 5. And how can then load constant 5, how can they fit into one kind of word? So this is a kind of problem. Therefore, how could we solve this problem? If we want to have all instructions to be of the same length.
Usually it's just like load this, and this is basically then the next thing on the program counter, like the next value after where my current program counter is.
Ah.
This word, then this instruction, we usually have like one word upload and one word data, which follows the output.
Ah. This is interesting. So in some sense, it's almost like having a variable length instruction in that you put the constant into the code, and you see the instruction says load the next value which comes into the instruction counter is a constant, which is put onto the stack. This would be one thing. Other architectures do it in this way, that they only allow small constants. And you kind of, if you want to have large constants, you have to combine them by two instructions. So there's something like load low and load high or something. So this would be in, I would not say that this is a more convenient one, but this is just another one how to do. So, but it means clearly, typically when the constants which you use will not be so large, typically you have small constants, but who knows? So if you are able to write large constants, why shouldn't you use large constants? Okay, so now, but here we kind of ignore such kind of technical details, like whether this is possible to store in 64-bit. But we simply assume that there's an instruction load constant 5. And now what would we do? So we would so down here is the code, kind of the, if you like, which realizes that. We first implement the stack pointer by 1, And then we place the 5 in on top of the stack. And here is the graphical representation. You see here, I liked to put the stack, to turn the storage, to turn it by 90 degrees, so that the bottom, that the one with address 0 is on the downside, and kind of this part, which is here and which is empty, considered empty, I do not draw, just to have a nicer pictures, and that you see the stack growing and shrinking. Yeah? So that also the stack pointer I did not make explicit, but leave it implicit and by graphically extending the stack. Yeah? So this is kind of the drawing convention, but I guess I will always write down this pseudo code below so that you see what the instruction really does. It's again a little bit ridiculous as I implement the virtual machine for C in something which is like C. Okay. Good. And you see, it satisfies all our conventions. Load constant 5 has no argument, no runtime argument, so therefore it consumes nothing from the stack. And it only returns a result, namely 5, and this it does by putting it on top of the stack. Okay, and now the multiplication, so that we need for our example expression, it takes 2 arguments, and so this is, for example, 8 and 3. It consumes them, so the stack pointer shrinks by 2, and then it pushes the result, so the stack pointer increments again by 1. So in total, the stack pointer decrements by 1, and the first argument, if you like, is replaced by the result. And clearly, there is So this is for the multiplication, and now we see. Okay, when I will evaluate arithmetic operations, I need all these other stupid things like addition, division, subtraction, modulo, and so on. And also there will be Boolean operations like AND or XOR, or comparisons like equal, not equal, and so on. And all of them are all these things here are binary operators, and we do it in the same way like multiplication, only that they do these other operations. And please recall here that in the C world, also Boolean values, are realized by integers. So there is no distinction between integer arithmetic and Boolean operations. So what is your question? No, here's no recursion. This is just one instruction. I then have to kind of, we will see later how the instruction looks for the full expression. For the moment, there's not the full expression. There's just one instruction. And I explain here the semantics of multiplication and nothing else. So there's also, yeah. And when I said, so there's just to recall, so that we all agree on that. So if we do... if we code Boolean values by integers, we kind of have to map, for example, false to some integer value. Which integer value is chosen for false, typically? 0. And what is true? 1. Always 1? Everything else, which is not 0. Non-null is true. Okay, so that is a kind of, so I'm not an inventor of C. I always, when I see it, I always get a little bit, as if I have to apologize for it. But C is a very old language, and perhaps they thought it was easier to map Boolean values to integer values. Java later on has kind of made a different choice, so they have real Booleans. but at least for C, they don't have real Booleans. There's one more thing which one has to take into account, that for multiplication is commutative. So it doesn't matter in which order we put the arguments on top of the stack. Now for other operators are not commutative. For example, subtraction, division, modulo, these are non-commutative operators. And so we must know what is the first argument and what is the second argument. Also for comparison operators like this less or equal. And what is the idea here? Well, the idea is the first argument is put onto the stack first. So therefore the lower value, so the 3 here, is the first argument, and the 7 here is the second argument. So therefore, 3 less or equal than 7, yes, this is true, therefore the result is 1. Okay? So this is the convention. And then besides these binary operators, there are also unary operators, like negation, or also the logical NOT operator. And negation this consumes an argument and returns an argument. Therefore, it replaces the topmost element on the stack by by the negated value. So therefore, for this unary operators, the stack pointer does not change. Okay? And now we can see how does the code look for 1 plus 7. So 1 plus 7. So we said we first generate code for evaluating the first argument. This is this one. Then we generate code for evaluating the second argument. This is this one. And then we generate code for the operator, which is this one. Yeah? And down here is the sequence, what happens at runtime. So doing the load 1 will push 1 on the top of the stack. Loading 7 puts 7 on top. And then addition consumes these two intermediate results and returns the result, 8. Okay? And so in that sense, you see here really the two phases of execution, of compilation. So this phase here is producing the sequence. This is the compilation. And this, and then letting run the sequence of code. This is the runtime. So you have compile time and runtime. And this corresponds to these two phases. Okay? So that was, for this arithmetic expression with, constants and operators alone. Now your question, what happens if we have this expression? Maybe we write it down. What was it? Times 4? Times 3? No, times 4. 8 times 4. It was 24, I think. Times 3. Yes, you're right. Times 3. You are perfectly right. So, okay. So then what do we have to do? This sequence, which is written down there, is the first argument. Now we have to provide code for the second argument. Load constant 3. And then we have to do the operator. That's it. And then we have the code for the whole expression. Yeah? And this, yes? Once again? What do you mean by different lengths? All of them have length 1. Yes. This is our convention, our simplification. The program counter increases always by 1. And every instruction, whether it is load constant 7, or whether it is add, have all the same length 1. We could use also his could follow his suggestion that these extra operators are put also into the code, and then we would mean that means load constant 3 would have then size 2. This but that kind of we could modify the main loop in this way, but for simplicity I did not do it. But we might do it in the exercises. I may ask Stefan to ask you to do it.
Somebody changing the instruction like it's just like the instruction is the execution of this like
yeah, yeah.
Next is still just take the next value, put it on the stack, and then set the program on to something.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like parting. It's kind of changing the execute. It would not change the anything else. Yeah. Okay, but this finishes it for today. Tomorrow is no lecture, and the next lecture we could still decide. Next lecture is next Monday. Is it better for you to start at 10, or is it better for you to start at 10:15 like today? Who is for 10 instead of 10:15? 3, and who prefers 10:15? The majority. So we stay with 10:15. Thank you very much and see you.